Today we're talking about a hustler, a young soldier, Chris Sari. I mean soldier metaphorically. I mean soldier in terms of his character, in terms of his tenacity, in terms of his hunger. This man, Chris Sari, is a climate activist and a researcher, and he got into the space first as a chemistry lab technician. So he was working for a chemicals manufacturing company, and he's trained as a scientist. And just from his personal experience, he witnessed so much waste going into his community in Uganda and going into the water. And he felt he had to do something about it. So like the many other crazy guests we have here, he quit his cushy job. And he decided to become a circular economist and climate educator, all right? We're talking about a young brother here who co-founded an organization called Save Uganda. He co-founded his own foundation, the Sari Environmental Foundation, okay? We are talking about a brother who was part of the Fridays for the Future movement and founded it in Uganda. He has been part of so many movements and so many organizations across Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, and globally, right? We're talking about Ubuni for Hub, 350.org, United for Climate Justice, Extinction Rebellion, Greenpeace, Youth Go Green, Umoja, Kwahaki, all right? Now, we can go on, but the thing that strikes me most and what I love most about this conversation is the man's persistence and resilience. It's nothing but a pleasure to have him on board. We have links for him and all guests in the description. Just go and look at his annual report for 2025. It's available online, talking about plastic pollution advocacy, community engagement, and the circular economy. I want you to listen in deeply and get ready to be inspired and to enjoy this conversation with young activist Chris Sari.
Welcome aboard our jet. The Just Energy Transition is a new podcast with the goal of amplifying the stories that matter most. Our mission: a just energy transition, raising the voices of untold inspiring stories. At JET, we hope every listener becomes a true activist and every story a catalyst for real change.
Chris, how are you doing, my brother?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. How about you there?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I think you've really got a lot to share with our listeners. I really do want to take it from the top in saying, let's begin. You currently, what are you doing? Just tell us about the broader movement you're a part of.
Thank you so much, Dr. Andani. Briefly, I'm Chris Sari, a climate activist from Uganda. I'm a co-founder of Umoja Kwa Haki ya Tabianchi. That's a Swahili version of United for Climate Justice. It is a global movement based in Europe, and they are doing works in empowering youth to advocate for climate justice, as well as building a network or coalition of movements, both in the global south and the global north. So our work is centered in advocacy for climate justice, as well as making the polluters and politicians accountable for the negative impacts they are doing on the environment, as well as the nature or this planet Earth.
Right. So just repeat the name of the local version, the Swahili version, that is?
It's Umoja Kwa Haki ya Tabianchi. Umoja means one, unity. Means unit. Mm. Tabianchi means climate. Then, aki, that's justice. moja kwa aki ya tabianchi. Tabianchi is climate, aki is justice, then umoja is unity. Umoja is unity. Oneness.
Wow. Oneness. Okay. So, oh man. So how do you translate that into English? How do you say that in English? You say one unity for climate justice. Is this how you'd say it?
United for climate justice.
Aha. I hear you. United for climate justice. And tell me, how did you get involved with this movement?
You know, as a climate activist in the Global South, at times you find that you just can't be limited to your locality or geographical location. You need to look for opportunities and see how best you can lobby for your communities and see also how best you can get resources. So in that struggle, we found ourselves getting the connectivity or connection from the Global North. That's where I landed in an organization which is rooted in Europe. So they started supporting our advocacy. They started working with us and empowering us to do our advocacy as well as training us so they can make us good leaders. Secondly, that is struggle that you can make ends meet. You find that you need to connect with more people. So I linked with the comrades who had to support me and led me into this movement.
Where did you find them? How did you just link with them? It's not like you just walk in the street and you bump into these people. You know, how did you end up in finding about this stuff, learning about this stuff, joining an organization? I mean, I can see you even have a shirt. Stop fossil subsidies,
fossil,
right?
Exactly. Subsidies.
Yeah, yeah. You don't just walk and have this shirt. It just comes on you. So how did you get involved really in the movement? Who did you meet? Where were you? You know, what piqued your interest here?
First of all, it's passion. The more you get passion and consistent in what you're doing, there are some things which join you on your way. As you just met, just energy transition. So the same way you are inspired, seeing what I'm doing, how I'm trying to do the grassroots work, how I'm empowering young people in my communities. So they were like touched, they need to work with us. So they were inspired to connect and that's why we got to work with them. So what you're saying is stop fossil subsidies. It's one of the campaigns we are doing in this global movement. You know, realize that with fossil subsidies, it's really very hard for us to have a just renewable energy transition, because at times we find like these corporations which are greenwashing us with terms like renewable energy and so on, they're doing less or nothing towards that good ambitious step. So what they are doing is just keep us, or they greenwash their activities in saying that they are the king of energy and so on. So with those fossil subsidies, it's really very hard for us to have a just renewable energy transition. It's really very hard for us to have a plastic global treaty and so on, because plastic is a waste product from fossil fuels. So we find that a lot of the system goes bazaar. Bazaar means something not clear. It goes unclear.
Okay, so
in this campaign, we push governments to remove, there are some minor subsidies which are unnecessary, but these oil and gas lobbyists, they find themselves use those subsidies to lobby, or they lobby those subsidies from governments and the other agencies or agencies internationally. So those subsidies are the ones which are fueling the climate crisis. Once you get them removed, then you shall have enough money to finance renewable energy, because it's what we are demanding, it's what we are anticipating, and we are sure it will work for the future. But with fossil subsidies, it will become a theoretical kind of ambition, which might be very hard to achieve with fossil fuel subsidies. So our demand to stop fossil subsidies so that we can have a just renewable energy transition, where we can have things working as the policies are saying, but these subsidies are the ones which are impeding or hindering us to attain that ambitious great goal, heal this world.
Now, I mean, you touched on something very particular. You know, others would touch on different kinds of fossils, but you touched on plastics. Why in your movement are you focused on plastic in terms of your branch, or should I say, of the global movement? Why would you choose to focus on plastics while others choose to focus on oil, and others focus on coal and so forth?
Yeah, you know, in this advocacy, we are all fighting for one. We all have one goal. Our goal is to create an ambient environment, is to heal this world. So as we chose plastic, advocacy against plastic pollution, because realized here in East Africa, it's one of the major crises. Plastic pollution in East Africa is a major crisis because it's evident. Even if you can't walk a few kilometers without finding plastic waste, floating in rivers, floating in drainage system. So those plastic bottles, they end up clogging and blocking drainage channels, which has made our brothers and lose life, which has made our brothers lose their property in flooding. So it was really more imperative for us to push our advocacy more on plastic pollution. We kind of can have policies aligned to mitigate that crisis. So not only in Uganda, but in the East African region.
Okay, so East African region. Now, when you say East African region, what are you told? Will you just define those boundaries for us exactly? What are you told? Which areas in the East African region that are most highly affected by this plastic pollution problem?
In East Africa, countries which are more affected by plastic pollution crisis, primarily have Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, but we have seen a great move in Rwanda. Rwanda did some kind of policy implementation, so they try to ban the plastic, single-use plastics, and they are working. But here in some countries in East Africa, like Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, those bans are like theoretical. They are not active. They are not implemented on grassroots. You find that what's documented is different from what's happening on the ground. For example, here in Uganda, we have a ban on single-use packaging bags below 30 microns, but we find that 30 microns is more in market circulating. So our advocacy demanding reduction in plastic production is really to have polluters who are making new plastic or virgin plastic, to have this plastic waste in our environment collected, then they can be recycled. So that's what we are pushing. But if you still have new plastic feedstocks or virgin plastics circulating from China, like Sinopec and other countries which are making these plastic virgin plastics, it's really very hard for us to have recycling or circular economy active or implemented. Because these are oil and gas lobbyists with billions and billions of money, they can even rob our governments.
So you've got a big fight up ahead of you. How many are you in the movement?
We have an executive committee of 10 people, 10 youths, and we also have dynamic volunteers from different universities in Makerere. We also have from Chambogo and East African universities. That's the movement here in Uganda. But we also have other people in the other countries who are doing the same work, tailored or aligned on the core values of the United for Climate Justice Global.
Right. How big is your membership on the ground beyond the executive committee?
Beyond the executive committee.
You've got 10 in the executive committee.
We have 10 executive committee members, and we have like 30 volunteers who are dynamic. At times they increase depending on the need and their availability, because they are students from universities. You might find that they are in examination period, so you find that the turn up might be low in some campaigns, but you can mobilize more youth from different institutions you are working with. You have more mobilizers who are available to join us in wherever you have a campaign here or initiative which we are doing in our communities.
Well, that's great. So I take it that you are already a graduate.
In 2017, I graduated from Chambogo University. So from 2017, been in different service or some works here in Uganda.
You graduated, what were you studying?
I did a diploma in science technology in chemistry. We are specialized in chemistry about technology. We do more of laboratory work, quality control, and material science.
Okay, so when you finished in 2017, what was your first job?
I've done quite a number of jobs, but the first job I did, it was more of electro engineering, where I channeled to another job of making cosmetics, skincare products, as well as pharmaceuticals. So I've done a number of jobs. Some are in line with what I studied, and others are not in line with what I studied. But because of survival, you need to do any work that comes your way to be productive and keep life going.
Have you ever heard of those mafia bosses that they go and they commit gigantic crimes, and then they come to church and they donate a lot of money to the church to make themselves feel better? Have you ever heard of such people?
Yes, I know. I know people who of that character who do gigantic crimes, but they masquerade in the churches. They do good charity, they do good work, but they are paired with bazaar, all kind of bizarre, kind of other crimes. They are there.
Can you assure me and our listeners that you are not one of those people? Because you started off with cosmetics. I'm listening to this stuff. You started off with cosmetics and skincare products. Are you sure it's not your guilt that made you say, hey, let me go into this climate stuff? Because, you know, my sins of working for these companies are haunting me, huh?
Yeah, actually, I'm onto those people with the gigantic crimes, as you prior elaborated. It happens, but my case is exceptional. As you know,
okay,
here
why?
In Uganda, at times you find the unemployment rate is high. Whenever you get the chance to do the work you have to do. So I'm one of those people who have been lucky that I have passed through a diverse of employment schemes, and I've done some quite of different works and jobs. So as I started in electrical engineering, I ended up doing the work which I studied. But what I realized in that environment where I was doing the work I studied, it was really disgusting. That as you know, the chemists work more of chemicals and quality control. So in that kind of environment I was working in, we were more exposed to chemical substances. Some are toxic and others are neutral. And most of them we are more of hazardous in making. So I felt like these things happening on me, but not only on me, but ends up affecting the environment where we are staying. Because at the end of that day, we are forced to release those chemicals into sewer system, but the sewer system could end up in wetlands and so on. So in wherever I used to sit down, I was imagining these chemicals are blended toxic, but they are ending up in the environment. How are they impacting the aquatic life? How are they impacting the water, the water quality our people are taking in our communities? So I felt like I've done a lot of things which are bad. So in that, I was pushed to join advocacy because I know it's not only me, there are more other chemists who are doing the same kind of work, especially those who are doing industrial production and so on. So I was triggered to join advocacy, pushing for a change, pushing for a working system where planet is a priority, not just a profit. People are pursuing profit, but you need to change the narrative that planet first, then profit comes next. So that's why I was ignited to join this climate activism ecosystem, where I've been inspired and linked to many people, and I've inspired many people as well.
You certainly have inspired me. That's why you're on the show. And so tell me, how did you, you speak about lots of unemployment and you speak about like a lack of opportunities in the environment. So didn't you feel like, am I going crazy? Am I leaving a job as a industrial chemical engineer to go and do this climate stuff? Did you not worry about your livelihood, your income? You know, did you just get up and say, bye-bye, I'm gone, I'm out of here? How did you really do this? I mean, given your context, people would say you're crazy.
Not necessarily leaving that profession, but it's more of culture or behavioral change. So I changed the behavior, but never changed the professional. So it's more of changing the behavior, the way we do, or the way we perceive, the way we do our work in our professional. So what I'm trying to do, I'm a chemist by professional, but I was going to change the way I will do things, so as well as see how best we can have others with that same kind of mentality that profits is paramount than planet. So we need to redefine our works, because not only in chemical engineering, but also in other faculties or other kind of employment or kind of services. It's not only in chemists, but even you go to medics, they have such kind of destructive behaviors they are doing to sustain their work or to do production and so on. So I never quit the professional. I'm still a chemist by professional, but we are prioritizing planet over profit, prioritizing environmental safety and health as a core of our work we are doing.
Is it umoja something that you do out on the side of your work? So you have a full-time job and then you do umoja as well?
Yeah, I have another job where we do eco-friendly, where we do plastic waste value addition under the same kind of work. We add value on plastic waste to make dust bins from polyethylene terephthalate. Those are PET bottles. These bottles for taking water, sodas. So we add value on that plastic waste to make dust bins.
That's excellent. Now, is that a company or is that a business, an enterprise that you, a new business that has been started? Or is that an established company that you're working for with like departments and so forth?
I can just term it as a social enterprise, because in this kind of work we are doing, we make these dustbins from plastic waste, then we sell them to shops, we sell them to pharmacies and other investments or other places which have picked interest in what we are doing. It's channeled to what we are doing, eco innovation and eco social enterprising. That's what I can term it.
So are you a co-founder of this enterprise, or were you hired?
No, I'm a co-founder.
Okay, and what would you say about its growth as an enterprise? You know, you don't have to give us specific numbers, but I mean, are you guys profitable? Are you guys growing in terms of market share? Are you able to sustain salaries? You know, are you able to run as an enterprise?
Yeah, sustainably, it's sustainable, and profitably, it's profitable, because at times we use waste, we add value on plastic waste. But at times here in Africa, most people, there's a problem with culture and perception, they perceive things. Most people feel more safe buying a dustbin made from an industry or established factory rather than supporting a youth startup. So, but it's sustainable and profitable. And I would invite more youths who are interested to learn more on these ideas and to innovate that we can provide solutions to the most pressing challenges in our communities.
So do you have a website? I mean, how do people find out more about this? You know, usually we leave this portion for the end, but I want you to plug it in right now. Do you have a website about this enterprise? I mean, I'm surely interested in it. Or where can people find out more about this work, this entrepreneurial work that you're doing apart from, which is not directly under Umoja?
Yeah, we are using a global website. That's not for climate justice global, UCJ Global. That's a website we are hosted in some of our activities we are doing. But we're also planning to build another website tailored to what we are doing here in Africa. But those are arrangements which are supposed to be executed this year, 2026. But initially, we are hosted on a global website. That's UCJ Global.
Okay, so right now, do you have a social media page where you are showing the dustbins you're making or anything like this? I really want to see what these look like.
You need to see how it appears. I'll show you a photo of how that dustbin looks like. After this conversation, I'll be sharing with you an image of that dustbin. It's a really interesting one. Even you can also make baskets, you can put your laundry closet. You also make this light chandelier, we call them chandelier. We make a lot of products from plastic waste, not only dustbin, but what I had to talk more because it's a kind of initiative which saves the environment and also providing solution to poor waste management. That's why I had to prioritize it more. But you make more other products from plastic waste.
Man, Chris, man, this is the kind of, you know, when we speak about Agenda 2063 and they say the Africa we want. They speak of the you. Yeah, this is, they're talking about you. You, they're talking about you. This is amazing. And you know what? I think you should push this more because I think it adds significant value already to the work you're doing under Umoja. So I want to have this work shared a lot more. And you and I will talk behind the scenes, you know, about sharing this work to see how it can get responses, because business is the ground and the foundation of our future green industrial economy here on the African continent. So coming back now to the problems you are solving, you know, which region are you in currently?
Currently, I'm in Uganda. Let's see, East African region, but in Uganda you have also sub-regions. You have Central, Eastern, Western, and Northern. But currently, I'm born and raised in Central Uganda. Yeah, where I'm residing is Central Uganda.
Central Uganda. What is the city or the district that you're in right now? What is it called?
The city is, I would say it's Wakiso, but it's more close to Kampala. Here it's called Chengera. Mm-hmm. Chengera is a peripheral urban area just close to Kampala.
Okay, it's called Chengera, just close to Kampala. So it's not really in the district of Kampala. And were you born and raised in Chengera?
I beg your pardon?
Were you born and raised in Chengera?
That story of where I was born is really very, very big. I was born in Nakaseke district. By then it was called Bulemezi, early 1984. It was called Bulemezi. But as the country is growing, we had to form a district from there. So you have Nakaseke district. That's where I was born. I was born there in 1994. That's when I was born. And during the course of life, I found myself relocating from Nakaseke district, where I'm residing now, in search for good services like education, medical services, and other essential needs for life. Because in some parts of Uganda, there are some communities where those services are really inadequate and hard to access. So that's why I was triggered. That's why I had to locate to come to this urban area where I'm residing now.
So you came from Lakesuka to Chengera. Have I got it right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you came from Lakesuka to Chengera now. And when was this? You were born in 1994. So when was this that you came to this urban district of Chengera, which is just bordering Kigali?
I traveled from that, from my home village, around 2004, around there. But though I was a young boy by then, I was just pushed to travel from there when I was still young in search for quality education, because I realized that that community is really marginalized and improvised, so it needed to groom its youth so that they can offer solutions and also try to empower others. So you are pushed to look for quality education, which was only available in Kampala by then. It was around 2004. And here in Uganda, it was somehow just developed because we are just grappling with the wars which happened in 1984 up to 1986 there. It took around 5 years. 1983 up 1986. So that war, it made many communities where I was born and raised. It was among the most affected community. We are supposed to be groomed with the youth of now. So you are forced to come to Kampala, the current capital city of Uganda, to get the quality education and to get other services to survive so that you can be a solution or change agents of this generation now.
You know, but Chris, how does a 10-year-old figure all of this out? That is a very tender age. Who told you must go to Chengera to get education as a 10-year-old child? And did you just, you know, I like the way you communicate. You know, you make miracles sound so easy. You know, you make miracles. You say, you know, I was just sitting one day and I decided to fly to the sun, and the sun was nice, and I came back. And we're saying, no, but how did you fly to the sun? How is this possible? So you have to tell us, as a 10-year-old child, how did you just get up and come to an urban city? What happened? Who spoke to you? What did you see? What was your experience?
Initially, actually, before telling you how I came from my home village to Chengera, during my tender age, you know, by that time, that was around 2004, I was around 10 years, just a young growing boy. So I have a story attached to the war, because as you're doing the digging, you find skulls of dead people in that where you're digging. So not only that, you find that you are traumatized mentally, and as a younger boy, you need to be mentally stable that you can be able to study and grow mentally. But for my case and my fellow youths who are still there, and some might have relocated to Kampala, we were traumatized because that age we faced a number of challenges related to the post-war. So like something after things happened after the war. So we were like surely traumatized, and we had our brothers and our people who had grown up. My brother was around 15 years. I had traveled to Kampala by a relative also. But that boy who was 15 years old had to find a place I can also come away from that village to Kampala. So when I came to Kampala, it's also another big story. He was supposed to mentor me, train me how best I can survive. So after I became resilient and I was able to survive with the guidance and also support from family members who are still in the village and others who are just joined Kampala. So that's how we are able to stay and survive up to now. But it's a huge story made with tears and some hoodoo, with some joy and so on.
My brother, I had to just take a pause there. You are, You're a resilient man, young man of grave proportions. So you, what you're saying is, as young kids, 8 years old, 7, 8, 9 years old, you are plowing in the fields, being taught by your grandmothers and your uncles and your families how to plow, how to farm in order to farm cassava and things, you know, vegetables and so forth, to subsist. And you're saying that while you are doing this, digging with hoes, plowing, you would hit solid objects, but they were not rocks.
Yeah,
these objects were not rocks; they were skeletons.
Yes, as you do the digging, as I told you before, that in that community where I was born, that's where the war of the transitional war for this current ruling government, it was more of that community. So we find that many people died during that war, and in the process, that some people, all those cows were unable to be buried. So find that as you do the digging, to maybe you're doing to do a digging a wall to plant cassava, to plant banana stem. So you find that you are digging on a skeleton of a human being. But due to government intervention, there are some locations or some places which are developed or facilities where they get those cows and put them, but most of them remain there. So that's what happened after the war. The skulls were very many in that community. So as you do the digging, you find the skull of a fellow human being who was alive 10 years back, but due to the war, they lost their life.
The skeleton remains and these skulls are unidentified people, right? We don't know who they are, who their families are.
Due to technology, DNA, the deoxyribose nucleic acid. So that DNA, we are able to trace the relative of those people. But after the war, the ceasefire has happened and the country is stable, some people are able to discover this skeleton belongs to this family. But it took time. It wasn't an instant process. It took time, like years and years. But most skeletons remained in those facilities, I would say, museum. Some people, they go there, they tour, but they can no longer be able to get and bury them because some people, they lost. They have never got the relative for those skeletons. Some might have been travelers from these far districts to that community.
Mm.
So most of them, they were never discovered their relatives and they are pushed to be put in that facility organized by government. It is there.
This is a very painful past, my brother. So you set out with this, seeking better opportunities in a more urban area, young 10-year-old man, and you came and met a relative, a distant family member who was at the around about age of 15, you say, and he started mentoring and training you on how to adapt to the city life.
Yeah, actually, that brother of mine now is around 45 years, around 40 years. He's older than me. That age range is somewhat older than me, around 40 years. You know, by the time I came to this town, I was young and I just can't imagine how old I was by then because I'm just getting like memories. I'm not sure which year I traveled from village to town. But what I know, I met with my relative who was also young. But he was just getting adapted. You know, he might be young in age, but he mature in actions. He was just young, but he mentored me up to a stage where I was able or I became resilient to sustain myself. Tender age as we are able to maneuver and survive. And by God's grace, he made people who could support us and so on. But that's how the story is. It's a huge story. Can take even some hours to this completion.
What were some of the most difficult things for you in that early stage of adapting to the urban life, the big city, big street culture? you know, at that age? What were some of your memories when you, those that you have and those that you can share, when you look back and you think, oh my goodness, how did I make it past that? Do you have any of those life lessons that you could share with us?
Yeah, actually, sorry, aside from traveling, you know, by then Uganda was, it was very, very poor. Although even now it's still poor, but by then it was more poor. Even some of the young boys were not supposed to be. We were not paying transport. You just enter a taxi, they sit here at the engine. There's a place where you call it a kameme in our local language. There's a place where the engine is for those taxis. So you sit there, you feel the temperature. It's really very, very hot. But as a young boy, you need to endure. And you reach town, by then we didn't have phones, these smartphones or cell phones on you. Mm. Then after you drop into a taxi park or a stage, then you have to look for these station phones. Those phones were put in some streets, but they are no longer available due to the mobile phone which came. Those phones are no longer available on the streets. So which on the street, you have a number written on a paper with a pencil. Then you write, you type the phone number, then you call a relative that I'm here at a taxi park. Then your relative will walk or will you get a taxi, then you come and pick you. But a person who traveled, a younger boy around 10 years who traveled, from 6 a.m. you reach in town at around 10 a.m. It took around another 5 hours me to get a person to pick me from the station because due to some circumstances. So that thing traumatized my mind. I'm just imagining how a person could struggle reaching a relative. It was very hard because they never had phones by then. After you called him, you leave that phone, then you go somewhere. You have no access of getting you where you are. So I stayed in town or a taxi park up to around 6 p.m. That's evening. I never got lunch, I never ate anything. But due to the fact that I was from village, when that conversative came, he explained everything, what he went through. So I also felt sympathy. I imagine I've come from a village where I've been eating jackfruit, eating mangoes, eating free bananas. Mm-hmm. He explained the story, how he managed to reach me. I really felt sympathized with him, but that's the life I just joined at that age. I was around 10 years. I felt sympathy as well. So the story started there, and I'm now in town. He showed me what I do for a living. At times I fetch the water for people. He gets jerrycans, fetches water. Mm. He takes to the people. They give him 200 shillings of Uganda. By then it had value, but these days no longer have value. By then if we get 100 shillings, that could be around five pancakes. So it could. That could be his lunch. So he trained me that what we had as a benefit, get education, it was almost free of charge. Just go there with your four books, sorry, mathematics, English, science, and SST, that's social study. So if you have those four books and a pencil, you could go and study free of charge. So that could be one of the benefit I gotten from traveling from village to town, then you could get free education. So I started studying. Although we do the fetching of water from class, you get jerrycans. You fetch water like 5 jerrycans, then you have your 500. That could be enough to sustain you the following day. So that's how life was. As we grew up, we are developing some mechanisms of survival and getting resilient. That's the story of. That's a brief story of how I grew up. So as I started from primary level, I reached secondary. you know, you have a vision, or you are saying that you are problem solver, or you are the messiah of the people who left in your village. Surely you are pushed to start the march so that you can offer solutions. And remember, your younger brothers and your people who left in the village, they really assume that you have the solution for them. So you are just imagine.
Because you're in the city.
I have to do greater that I can support my people. You have a lot of things which are pushing you, but there are circumstances which are pushing you that you can change the story of your family. So I studied successfully. I finished second. I got a government scholarship. But second, I was studying a lot of paying school fees for myself. And somewhere to could support me with some money, because second year in Uganda, it was to be paid for. It wasn't free as primary. Primary was free, but second, you were supposed to pay some money. So you could endure and do some work. You fetch water, you carry some we call them luggage. You carry luggage at your chest or at your back. You carry those luggage, get some money to survive, and also try to get just school fees for that term. But by God's grace, I got in the government scholarship at university. I was able to study that diploma. That was 2017. I graduated on a government scholarship. That's a brief story. A lot is behind that, but I'm just breaking the, not to make this podcast too big, but there's a huge story of how I reached this age.
Man, it's my brother, I want to salute you, because I want to salute you. I can see it in your eyes. I can see it in your face, man, that there's a lot that you had to go through to be to where you are. What's moving me the most, Chris, is that it hasn't killed your humanity. You know, there's people who go through things and they lose. You can see it in their faces. They become, you know, you can see the anger in their faces, you know, because of their... But with you, there's none of that, man. And I just think you're just a breath of fresh air to the continent. So what is it that made you now, when you were finishing secondary, why did you choose to study chemical engineering and not anything else? Why did you choose that specifically?
Actually, my dream was to become a doctor. But in Kiswahili, we say, Simba ikikosa nyas, ikisimba ikikosa nyama, itakula nyas. That's what it means in English, that once a lion fails to get meat, it eats grass. So as a youth, I had a dream of becoming a doctor. So because in my community there, where I was born, the people, we had no access. I would say no access to medical service. So I realized that as a youth who is trying to look for solution in my community, I need to become a doctor so that I can be a solution to my people where I'm born from. Due to some circumstances, I was unable to get that scholarship for government to study in medical medicine. So I was pushed to study chemistry, laboratory technology. But after studying and graduating, I realized that what I studied also is another solution, because as the world grew, or Uganda grew, realized that chemical pollution is becoming a huge problem than even medical or lack of medical service. Chemical pollution is too much here in Uganda. So that study, or that course I studied, I realized that it was God's grace that I was able to study that, because I can now offer solution. I can offer a solution to the chemical challenges or chemical pollution in my community, as well as being the voice of the people who never went to school, who never studied, that I can test push policies which can help to save them from what could be hazardous in the future. But the problem also is that the problem is at higher pace than some of us could do. Could solve. That's why we need to empower more people. We need to amplify the voices so that we can have many people aware and enlightened of how this crisis is affecting humanity, so that we can also be the voice to the voiceless nature. Because as you know, where profits is prioritized than planet, it's nature which suffers. And also the majority who are marginalized, they also suffer. That's why we need to see it's an opportunity. Me studying chemistry is an opportunity. Then what I was, I thought maybe becoming a medical doctor could solve a problem. Also, what I studied is a solution as well.
And possibly one with a unrecognized but much greater impact. I salute that, and that's sort of that you know. So you graduated from there, and you got started in this company. When was the first time, you know, just before you left the company, when was the first time that you actually heard about a climate NGO? When did you encounter one? Did you find them? Were they distributing pamphlets? Did you hear about them while you were a student on campus? You know, how did you come across these organizations in order to realize that there is an opportunity for you to participate?
Oh, so it's unfortunate that me personally, I never found any organization or NGO in environment, but it was inculcated in me when I was still in primary school. There was a gentleman, you know, I studied in a missionary school where there is a boys and girls brigade, they were scouting. So in scouting, we were taught those values of conserving environment. We were trained to plant trees, trained not to litter. But it was on a smaller scale because by then, some people were going to school, others were not going to school. So I found that I was among the people who were groomed, empowered, that I can get those values of conserving environment. Then when I was in secondary school, I had that kind of that value, or that culture or discipline inculcated in me, and I could do some charity and planting trees in the compound in secondary school. I joined the university. That's when I had to amplify, or I had to upscale, or to bring that kind of this culture to practice in my community. So I left from school, planting trees in school, churches, and I had to go to communities, so I planting the trees as well. But as I started, as when I went on in this advocacy, I realized that planting trees is not enough when there's someone who cuts the tree than you are planting. So I had to join advocacy, demanding to stop deforestation. By then it was Mabila Forest in Uganda, which was under invasion. People were cutting Mabila Forest very faster than we can plant the trees. So I was ignited to do advocacy to save Mabila Forest. That's when I was in the university.
Was this for timber plantations? What were they cutting it for?
We were cutting Mabila Forest for wood, for
timber,
for firewood, planting sugar cane by then. So I was ignited to do advocacy.
So was that
Mabila
commercial
Forest,
or was that community-based? Was it that people who were just, who were gathering the wood there, or was it commercial companies?
Both. It was both companies and also individuals. Individuals want firewood from the forest. They go, they cut a tree. So it was really rampant and uncontrollable. We who are planting trees, we plant one tree or trees in a compound, while like doing nothing. So I started, because I was at university, I calculated we are planting 5 trees a week. People are cutting 10 trees per hour because they're using some machines to cut the trees. So I was ignited to see that I need to push advocacy that you can save Mabila Forest, because the rate at which people are cutting trees is surpassing the rate we are planting. So that's when I joined advocacy. Joined advocacy, plant trees, to save Mabila Forest. I was also ignited to join more advocacy because I had already just started campaigning for climate justice, because by then it was one of the major pressing challenges. As you moved to 2015, I realized that there are many other injustices because I had studied now. I tried to read on chemical ingredients in different products we take as food and so on. I realized that surely we are slowly dying. So I just imagined again how these people are adding this chemical, which is toxin. And I know it kills, even it causes cancer and so on. I was really traumatized again. That's why I had to seriously join climate activism, because I believe is a solution to what's pressing this planet. Because an earth environment or a dying environment cannot sustain living people.
I'm with you. And so tell me something around this region bordering Kigali, Chengara, and other areas there in Uganda. What are the effects? You know, we spoke about plastic earlier on, and you just spoke about how rampant plastic is floating in every aquatic system that is can be seen by the naked eye from that terrain. But you know, are there any other significant pressing issues that are getting in the way of or that are visible that you encounter every day over and above plastic? Or do you feel that if as Africans, when it comes to the Eastern African community of Uganda, if we focus solely on plastic, we will have dealt with a big chunk of the problem affecting the Ugandan community?
Actually, before I go to plastic pollution, you know, there's also another problem which arisen after people had start to or increase their consumption on single-use plastic. The soil productivity reduced in Uganda. I would say in Uganda, because I'm sure when soil productivity reduced here in Uganda, people started to use or to apply the so-called agrochemicals, the fertilizers. So when they introduced fertilizers, because wanted to combat or to increase soil productivity, which was the result of plastic, because plastic bottles, plastic packaging bags, so they reduced the soil productivity. What they did, they had to start using fertilizers. And they applied fertilizers on that soil. The soil again deteriorated to be more productive. So that deterioration it also caused triggered more farmers to look for other space to do farming. So looking for the space to do farming, they started cutting trees. So when they started cutting trees, yes, it caused the forest cover to reduce here in Uganda and other countries in East Africa is happening. But for the plastic problem or pollution, it's not only that we are seeing many plastic waste here alone, but also we have seen the chemicals which are embedded or which are the chemicals of the plastic are really hazardous to the general consumers, because most of the packaging, the plastic packages, maybe I would say the disposable glass, the say disposable cups, these are plastics. People they normally put hot tea, hot drinks. So the chemical content in the plastic alone is also hazardous, and it causes cancer. But people they are not aware. So our advocacy against these chemicals which are causing cancer, which are exposing our people to risk of diseases, we also try to push regulations. That's why in August this year, 2028, shall be having a global plastic treaty again in Geneva. But I pray that this time round it's not sabotaged, because last year we had many lobbyists, the fossil fuel and plastic giants, the lobbyists, they came into the sabotage design. Yes?
Did you attend last year?
Yes, they sabotaged the signing of that treaty. That treaty could offer solutions to the global plastic treaty supposed to be signed last year. But this year, 2028, again, shall be having the treaty again to sit and see so that you can have those chemicals which are hazardous to the consumers banned, not to be put in production or put in those products. Because when we have those chemicals, we are sure that people will be getting sick and the aquatic environment is jeopardized or is at risk. A lot of risks are attached to the plastic waste or plastic products.
So this plastic treaty you're saying that's happening this year in August in Geneva, last year, where did it happen?
It was actually not only last year, that it's been a huge journey. We have been having the INC 4, INC 5, and many intergovernmental negotiating committees have been sitting so that we can have that treaty, but it's always been in vain. Also last year, we were supposed to have that treaty signed, but it went in vain. That's why we are praying that this year, 2026, it can be signed. There are these oil and gas lobbyists as well as the plastic giants who are hindering that treaty to be signed because that's it's touching their profit. As I told you before, we should have a system which protects the planet first, then also profit comes next. Because a deadly planet cannot sustain living things, cannot sustain living people. But the problem always happens, there are few people, it's a system which benefits few, living majority suffering. So that's a system which are hindering these policies or in the implementation of these policies and treaties to be signed. Once this treaty is signed, you could have governments accountable, you could have things changing, but without a treaty or any document or governing document, a binding one, it really could be very hard for us to have this planet healed because at times we are fighting giants, we are fighting corporations which have the capacity even to influence our governments. That's why we need, especially in the global south, it's more imperative for us to have these treaties. Never know it could help us to see that we can make ends meet.
So if this treaty is signed, it's the Global Plastic Treaty? Is that that's what it's called?
Yeah, it's called the Global Plastic Treaty.
Right, so if this GPT, but the Global Plastic Treaty, if this GPT is signed, to what extent would it impact East African communities like yours, and to what extent would it impact your work in Moja there in Uganda? You know, would the Ugandan government sign up for it? Why do you put your hopes up into this plastic, the Global Plastic Treaty so much in terms of its efficacy? Other countries may sign up to it, but are you sure your government will sign up to it? If not, what is the usefulness of the treaty to the work you do still as a plastic change makers, let's call it that, at Umoja?
Well, if you get the treaty signed, I'm 100% sure that you shall be able to get polluters, maybe like, I'm sorry to say, Unilever could be accountable for their plastic footprint. With that treaty, they'll be able to pay these startups in Africa, like in Uganda, even us inclusive, because they're doing great work that we can reduce their plastic footprint in circulation, which are floating, which are swimming in our lakes, which are buried under the soil, which are choking our planet in simple terms. Once that treaty signed, shall have corporations accountable. Shall also have the treaty signed, also we shall be having some chemicals which are hazardous to aquatic organism and also human being or the consumers. Those chemicals will be removed into the production line. But without the treaty, it really could be something very hard. You know the problem, but you can't solve it due to lack of a policy which is governing a system, which is governing the production process. So that treaty is really a good instrument to, especially for us who are advocating for a plastic pollution-free communities. It's really a good instrument, and it's one of the solutions. We are sure once the treaty is signed, shall be able to have resources, finances to upscale our initiatives on that grassroots.
Yes, like apart from this global pollution treaty, which is very important, what is your program of action? What are the steps and what are the things you guys want to accomplish as Umoja for the coming future?
We are looking at having a number of initiatives which are empowering our communities, because we are after providing a solution, a working solution to pressing challenges in our community, not only environmental but also political. You know, a politically failed state might not consider environmental health and safety a priority because it's unstable. So you're also grooming leaders who are able to be a voice for the marginalized people, a voice for nature, mm-hmm. a voice to the voiceless. So you are looking to empowering many people as also bringing solutions to our communities. That's what we are looking in the future. Mm-hmm. By God's grace, we are able to reach there. We shall be able to have a legacy of people who have groomed, who are poor leaders, who are environmentalists, who are educators. That's our legacy. That's our vision, to groom and empower youth to offer solutions to the pressing challenges in their communities.
Man, and you're a living example of that. This conversation has been very, very fascinating. You mentioned UCJ Global. That's where people can learn more about Umoja. Do you personally have your own social media pages or any other links or any online resources that you think people should go and check out and read?
Yeah, as UCJ Global, we have online platforms, but also as Umoja Kwa Haki ya Tabianchi, that's United for Government Justice Uganda, we have social media platforms. On Blue Sky, we have a page. On Instagram, we have a page. On Twitter, we have a page. And also, we are building a page on LinkedIn. Sorry, we have social media platforms where we publish our work. But also, for more details, you can reach out to UCJ Global, UCJ.global. That's where you can get more details about all the groups available in Europe and Africa, which are working under that umbrella or coalition.
I mean, very, very, very powerful mission, very powerful story. Now, no guest gets to escape this podcast without justifying why they were awarded a first-class seat on the JET, the Just Energy Transition podcast. So how we usually do it typically is a brief sentence. Hi, my name is Chris Sari, and I deserve a first-class seat on the JET because ... And that because should be a brief statement on the work that you do and what makes you a valuable participant of this movement, something that if nobody listens to anything else we've discussed, they can take that away and know what Chris and Umoja are about and walk away inspired. Are you ready?
I'm Chris Sari, climate activist from Uganda. I'm a great candidate for the GET Award, that's Just Energy Transition Award, because we are pushing solutions. We are empowering communities to push solutions which are posing challenges in their communities. You know, as an activist, especially in the Global South, you have many people who are oppressed than those who are oppressing. So it's really more imperative for us to have these voices, our voices amplified. And also, you are pushing for just energy transition, the advocacy to stop fossil fuel subsidies, as well as the advocacy to demand the Global Plastic Treaty. All these programs, all these advocacies are really need support, they need amplification or upscaling so that we can build a working system or a just environment for everyone to thrive, not the few to benefit, leaving the rest marginalized and leaving the planet at mess. They just pursue profits and so on for them to benefit, leaving majority are suffering. So it's really imperative for us to get this award because we are sure if we are awarded, we are motivated to empower more other people, to empower our communities so that we can build a working system for everyone, not the few. Because if I'm empowered, I can empower the rest. If I'm not empowered, the rest won't be empowered. So it's really imperative to have us awarded so that we can upscale or we can take our work to the next level as we're pushing to build a working system, a working environment for everyone. As I told you, that a dying planet cannot contain living things. So we need to build this planet to its normal that it can sustain us and the rest of the future to come.
Chris Sari, ladies and gentlemen of Umoja. Dude, you've been amazing. You've been amazing. Thank you for joining the show. Thank you for joining the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you have hosted me, and I'm sure we shall be able to come again and again to elaborate and tell more of in our struggle or in our advocacy so that we can have the planet working and have policies aligned to offer solution, not to benefit few, those who are capitalists, those who are after profits here. I'm so glad that you have hosted me. Thank you, Dr. Andan, for this opportunity. I'm so glad. Thank you.
Salute.
Thanks for tuning into our JET podcast today. Before you disembark, don't forget to subscribe and stay connected. For more resources, updates, and ways to take action, visit jetvoices.com. Until our next JET flight, stay inspired, stay engaged, and keep pushing for a just energy transition.